This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Can we improve quality of life for people without that necessarily involving more stuff and more money? For many of us, we have enough stuff and money. How can we improve our quality of life by thinking about quality of experience, about quality of engagement with others, about quality of engagement with nature?
Can a spirit of adventure lead us to more sustainable living? This week on Sea Change Radio, we try to answer that question. First, I speak with Jem Bendel, a sustainability professor who's put together the upcoming Adventures in Sustainability Conference taking place in London May 27th. Next, we hear from Kate Rawls, an environmental travel writer who rode her bike from Texas to Alaska to raise awareness about climate change. And then I talk to Ed Gillespie, a sustainability communications consultant who circumnavigated the globe without flying. So I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Jem Bendel. He's now a professor of sustainability leadership and founding director of the Institute for Leadership and Sustainability at the University of Cumbria in England. Jem, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you very much, Alex, for having me back.
So you organized and were inspired to put together a conference that's happening in May in England about sustainability and adventure. Why don't you first talk about this event?
I'm founding this new Institute for Leadership and Sustainability in the northwest of England. And when I arrived here, I discovered that the campus has a 100-year heritage for experiential learning, so learning in and from nature. That was fascinating to me. And I thought, well, how do we really use that and revive that given the current global challenges we face? And I thought, adventure. Adventure is this idea that we all know about and inspires us. And I feel that there's a real lack of adventure in the environmental movement at the moment. We are so cautious in terms of how we communicate what we do. And really, so many people I've met in the last few years who have become quite senior in various walks of life in the sustainability field don't really feel that what they're doing really adds up to the systemic shift to sustainability that we need. And I thought, well, why don't we get together and inspire each other to be much more adventurous, much more bold in our work? And this is the sort of the ethos for the Institute. So when I was looking at how to communicate that, I thought, well, A, who are the really exciting people who are leading on sustainability in their professional lives? But also taking some really interesting personal actions themselves, things which are unusual feats, such as circumnavigating the globe without flying, or cycling across North America, talking to people about climate change, or reconnecting with their local environment through wild swimming. People who I felt were inspiring.
So are you hoping to kind of re-engage these people who otherwise would leave the movement and bring them back into the fold?
Yeah, I could say that. I've noticed that as the environmental movement has become more incorporated into business, finance, and government, and so on, although we've seen a lot of incremental progress because of that, I think the environmental movement as a whole has got a bit stale. We have to realize that the sum total of all the things we're doing is not adding up to the systemic shift we need. But really, we need people to stay in this profession and in this movement. Who do recognize the quite scary scale of the challenge and to work towards real systemic change, a transition to a more sustainable way of life. Now, I feel that the spirit of adventure is something which I think could inspire us to do that, to not be put off by the fear of the future, to not be put off by a concern that what we're doing is not enough, to actually try and work together and celebrate those instances where people are being bold and ambitious and achieving great things for sustainability.
Well, it sounds like a great event. Jam Bendel, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. I look forward to talking again one day.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Kate Rawls. She's a lecturer at the University of Cumbria and an author of The Carbon Cycle. Kate, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure.
So your sustainability adventure encompassed riding your bike from Texas to Alaska. First, why did you do this? And I would like to learn more about some of the characters you met along the way.
So it was a mixture of a love of adventure and particularly cycling in mountains. And I guess key to that was that I didn't just cycle from Texas to Alaska up the coast, but I was trying to keep as close to the Continental Divide as I could. So I was crisscrossing over the Great Divide. So there was definitely an adventure logic in what I was trying to do. But I was really interested in the whole question of what, in quotes, ordinary North Americans think about climate change. And this was back in 2006, so this was at the height of the Bush administration.
And you were also in some pretty red states.
I was. I was in Texas, for example. A lot of states where I met some really, really interesting opinions and views about climate change, about global warming, about whether it's happening, and if so, why it matters. And of course, about what we should do about it.
Well, first I have to ask why you decided to go towards the mountains. If any sane person were biking from Texas to Alaska, and I guess that kind of eliminates that right there, but why would you want to go up hills? I would want to stay as flat as possible if I were taking on such a large task.
I don't know why exactly. I love cycling in mountains. Yeah, you have to go up, but then you have the most extraordinary views. And then, of course, you get the downhills as well. So there's something about that contrast that I absolutely love. But I guess the wider climate change logic was that mountains have been called the canaries of climate change by ecologists. And the concern is that mountain ecosystems are going to be impacted by climate change sooner and more abruptly than other ecosystems. And I sort of wanted to explore that a bit because I've always loved mountains. And that was a kind of a concern for me. Is this happening? And if so, what does it mean?
And can you talk about just logistically from England to Texas and getting prepared for this trip? How long did it take you, for example?
Well, that was an interesting one. I trained pretty hard up until about May, but then I was trying to set up interviews and meetings. I had an interview with one of the cool city mayors, the mayor of Albuquerque, and I was trying to set up stuff all the way along my route. So it ended up that I spent a month in my office. By the time I hit Texas, I was pretty unfit, which was interesting because when I left, it was 110 degrees, and I had this quite testing schedule, let's just say, to cycle 75 miles a day. But anyway, so that was part of it. In terms of how I actually physically got there, I flew. And of course, that raises some really big questions and dilemmas because in terms of a person's personal carbon footprint, a transatlantic flight takes a pretty big chunk out of it. All the way through the trip, I was sort of confronting my own relationship with high carbon lifestyles, with flying, and so on, and trying to work that through as I cycled along, as well as exploring other people's ideas and attitudes towards it.
How long did it take to get from Texas to your endpoint in Alaska?
I had three months, and I sort of thought this was going to be a relatively easygoing trip. On an average of 75 miles a day cycling, that should have left me 2 months of cycling in a month to take days off here and there, to follow up interesting opportunities, meet people, talk to people, and so on. As it turned out, I had a lot of headwinds. I had a lot of heat to start with, and then a lot of adverse weather in Colorado when I was going over the higher passes. So my mileage went down and down and down, and it ended up as being a bit of a scramble, to put it mildly, at the end to get to Alaska. And that was an issue because I was coming half the way back by ferry, and it wasn't just the last ferry that I was trying to catch that week or that month. It was the last ferry for that year. So if I'd missed that ferry, I would still be in Alaska.
Let us be a fly on the wall for a second with some of the conversations you had about climate change with the characters in some of the reddest states of America that you traversed.
So in some of the so-called redder states, and I would say in every state, you meet people at both ends of a spectrum. You meet people that are passionate about the issue and care a lot and are doing everything they can. But I guess one of the things that surprised me was that I met people who really hadn't heard of climate change, didn't really know what I was talking about. And a quote that I think sums that up is somebody I was talking to in New Mexico. It was just before I got into Texas. And he said, "Climate change? Well, you won't find anything like that till you get further north," which was a really sort of strange thing to say about a global phenomenon. And when I tried to unpack that a bit, he didn't know what climate change was. And it wasn't just that he didn't understand it. I don't think he'd ever heard of it. And that led me into some interesting questions about the media in some parts of the United States in particular, and how climate change was being reported or not being reported at that time. So I guess that was one end of the spectrum.
How did they view you?
Well, you know, that was a really mixed thing. On the one hand, practically everybody I met was just so friendly and helpful and nice. I think if you turn up somewhere alone on a bicycle with big panniers, clearly on tour, and I think perhaps especially as a woman alone, people come and talk to you. They typically say things like, "Are you crazy? And you're going where? And why don't you have a car?" But then the next sentence, it'll be, "Can I buy you a beer?" Or, "Have you had lunch?" Or, so I was really overwhelmed by the friendliness. But I had a lot of people telling me in the next breath that, you know, I was crazy and I was mad and, you know, what the heck was I doing? And yeah, why wasn't I in a car? So it was very, very, very mixed, very positive and very mystified often.
And had you been to all of these states before, or was this an adventure for you in many ways in terms of relating to a side of America that you hadn't really explored?
I had spent 2 years in Colorado in 1988-89. So I knew Colorado well 20 years ago, and I had friends in Colorado. And I had touched on New Mexico, but I'd never been to New Mexico properly. I hadn't really explored much of Texas, and I hadn't ever been to Wyoming. And I hadn't been much further north either, so Alaska was a whole new ballgame.
That you love me, that we would never part. Yes, you told me that you love me, that we would never part. But it seems as though couldn't control your wandering heart.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Kate Rawls. So we hear about sustainability adventure, and not everybody can relate to being able to get on a bike and riding 4,500 miles across North America. Maybe you can just tell about some of the more mundane parts of your life that are an adventure in sustainability without having to reinvent the wheel, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I absolutely agree. Not everybody is going to get on a bike and go for a long ride. But behind that, I think there's a really important question, which is, what do we mean by quality of life? And can we have a higher quality of life than we have now, whether that's in an industrial society or a developing emerging society? Can we improve quality of life for people without that necessarily involving more stuff and more money, or without that always involving more stuff and more money. Some people clearly need more stuff and more money, globally speaking, than they already have. But for many of us, we have enough stuff and money. How can we improve our quality of life by thinking about quality of experience, about quality of engagement with others, about quality of engagement with nature? All of those things are really in your face on a bike trip. What gives me quality of life? How much stuff do I need? And how amazing to have time to be able to relate to other people and to nature in a different way. We don't normally have that kind of time, but can we take those messages back with us into our mundane world and sort of step outside consumer culture for a while? That I definitely took back with me as a take home. How do we have more time, better quality experience, and less focus on stuff?
And how have you moderated your view and your behavior in terms of your material world around you?
I think that's an ongoing challenge, isn't it? It's when you step out of your normal world, it's easier to see it from a different perspective and to have these questions about, well, how much stuff do I really need? When you go back into it, then it's easy to lose sight of those bigger questions. So I've tried to stay in touch with that. I've definitely thought really, really hard about the flying thing. That my own sort of relationship with flying was relatively unquestioned when I went on this trip. I assumed it was justifiable because I was going for 3 months and I was trying to use it to communicate about climate change to a wide audience. But I ended up thinking, my flight was no more important than anybody else's, and we really need to think hard about that. So one thing I've done is adopt a self-imposed ration, if you like. So I try not to fly more than once every 3 years. But to offset that in terms of my quality of life, I go sea kayaking a lot in Scotland, and that's just been an absolute joy. So I try to think about the flying thing as a positive thing rather than as a sacrifice. It's not that I'm not flying so much, it's just that I'm spending more time in Scotland. And I guess everybody would have their equivalent of that.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with author Kate Rawls. She is a senior lecturer at the University of Cumbria. Kate, if you can step away from your personal experience with your cycling trip for a moment and talk about the environmental movement.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that strikes me about sustainability adventure is right now it's mainly something that hip white people from 30 to 50 years old tend to gravitate to. How do we use that either as inspiration for non-hip white people from 30 to 50 to get involved, and everyone else? How do we start to expand the movement? What gives you hope that we can spread the message of sustainability and environmentalism to more than the low-hanging fruit?
Well, I think what gives me hope is sustainability is not optional. There's a great piece of communication that WWF did, which said that basically, for everybody on the earth to enjoy the lifestyle of an average industrialized person, by 2050, we're going to need three planets. And so the problem there is self-explanatory. We have only one planet. One planet living is not an option. Whether or not we choose to transition to one planet living, or whether we are forced in that direction, that is a big choice. And I think it's a choice that everyone is going to want to make. So that's part of the piece. The other part of the piece is that we like to think we're the most intelligent species on the planet. And we're fantastically creative, and we have these huge brains. What better use of our big brains to think about how everyone on the planet could have a good, decent quality of life, a better quality of life than many people have now, without costing three planets? Because clearly that's just not an option. So I am optimistic. This is an agenda that is totally relevant to everyone. The challenge, of course, is to engage people in that, to communicate that effectively, and to communicate it with an appropriate sense of urgency and passion without thereby putting people off.
So are you more hopeful because of technological advances that we'll be able to somehow survive on this one planet, or do you think it's going to be raising consciousness?
I think technological advances are absolutely critical, but I don't think they're enough in themselves. There are all sorts of reasons for thinking that. Some of them is to do with the sheer maths. If you were to crunch the numbers, it shows that the great divide that we've got to get across between where we are now and where we need to get to, you just can't do that through technology alone and meet our carbon targets and reduce our impact on biodiversity and. And so where you get to is the conclusion that actually we need to step back and think hard about our values, about what actually is important for quality of life for human beings on planet Earth, and how much stuff we actually need to give us quality of life. That, I think, is a really, really important question that is easy to duck and often does get ducked, but needs to be absolutely confronted head on. What gives us quality of life, and how do we transition away from a high consumption, highly materialistic model of that?
And it's as you mentioned earlier, it's so easy to talk about the people who, there are so many people who don't have enough money and stuff. And so to find that delicate balance between lifting up the people who are impoverished and are the last thing on their mind is solving the climate change problem, versus people who are worrying about buying their third or fourth automobile.
Sure. But you know, those people, the poorest in society and the poorest in the world are always going to get hardest hit by climate change. You know, those people may not have the privilege of being able to worry about what they personally can do about it, and they are the people that are contributing the least to it, but they're always the hardest hit. So this idea that, you know, environmentalism is a middle-class luxury, absolutely not the case. If you are immediately dependent on your environment for fresh water, let's say, or your forest for firewood, and that forest or that river is put in jeopardy, then you have no water or you have no firewood. So the poorest are the people that are the most immediately vulnerable by environmental degradation, not the richest.
Kate Rawls, her book is The Carbon Cycle, and if you are a student at the University of Cumbria, go listen to her lecture. Kate, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I was a highwayman, along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade. Many a soldier shed his lifeblood on my blade. The bastards hung me in the spring of 25. But I am still alive.
I was a sailor. I was born upon the tide. With the sea I did abide. I sailed a schooner around the Horn of Mexico.
If you ever find yourself wanting to know more about the music we play here on Sea Change Radio, go to seachangeradio.com and click on the music tab at the top of the page.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Ed Gillespie. He's the founder of Futera. Ed, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, nice to meet you, Alex.
First, why don't you tell our listeners what Futera is all about?
We're a specialist sustainability communications agency that I co-founded with my business partner Solitaire about a dozen years ago, and our mission is to make sustainable development so desirable it becomes normal. I've been working all over the world with various different large businesses, governments, campaigning organizations, and we always try to encourage people to look to the positive, compelling aspiration of an attainable vision of the future, rather than threatening everyone with the doom, gloom, and Armageddon stick.
So we're talking about sustainability as an adventure. Talk about some of the adventures that you've embarked on and how you've incorporated a non-sedentary life while still being conscious of your carbon footprint.
Yeah, so, I mean, we're heading towards bumpy times, already in bumpy times. And so I think we have to have this sort of pioneering, adventurous mindset as we go forward. Well, I've done a lot of work on climate change over the years, but was always very acutely conscious that my own carbon footprint was a major issue, and that some of the practices like, you know, frequent flying were making me look slightly hypocritical. So about 5 years ago, I embarked on a round-the-world circumnavigation without flying by buses, trains and cargo ships. And for me, it was about not so much about hair shirt sacrifice, but about smart substitution. You can still have this amazing adventurous lifestyle. You can do it in a low carbon and really attractive way.
Explain what the logistics of trying to circumnavigate the globe without getting on a plane entailed.
It's a lot of patience. You need to be quite resourceful, but you also need to sort of reconcile yourself to a different pace of travel. And that's actually the beautiful thing. You have this kind of continuous narrative that unfolds in front of you, the slow transition of landscape, culture, people, language, cuisine. And you realize actually the things that we share in common, the things that bind us together, are much, much more powerful than the kind of the relatively petty differences that divide us. And you really appreciate that intimately when you travel through a landscape rather than buzzing over it 45,000 feet.
But what were some of the more daunting challenges logistically?
Well, yeah, when crossing the big blue wobbly bits of the oceans are obviously some of the more difficult bits. You know, you get to the edge of a continent and you think, well, how do I get to the other side of the Pacific? And so the way that we chose to do it was by trying to find out about cargo ship routes and freighter travel. And then obviously that means trying to kind of book a passage. I mean, a lot of freighter companies don't actually take passengers. And once you've got your crossing secured, it's not bad, but they are still very much working ships. You know, it's like a cruise, but without 5,000 other passengers and the terrible cabaret.
How much does it cost?
It's about the same as a cheap hotel normally. You know, it's about probably for a cabin is around about $60 to $80 a day, but that includes obviously your bed and board and, you know, three meals a day. They kind of feed you within an inch of your life. Depending on the nationality of the crew, that can be a lot of meat and potatoes. Or if you're lucky and you get a sort of Filipino crew, you get a lot more fried fish and tasty stuff.
And it must take quite a long time to cross the Atlantic or Pacific on a cargo ship. About 2 or 3 weeks, is that correct?
Yeah, we're talking about, crossing the Pacific from New Zealand to Mexico took about 16 days. Across the Atlantic from Costa Rica back to the UK, it was around about 13 days. You know, these things chug along at a fair old rate, but it's certainly not speedy.
That's not so bad, though. Costa Rica to the UK in 13 days. So they were making a decent pace at that point. It wasn't like they were stopping, as opposed to a cruise ship that would stop in every port of call.
Exactly. And that was actually on a boat full of bananas, bringing back bananas for the UK market. So, you know, you're sort of rolling along in an Atlantic swell with several thousand tons of unripened bananas underneath you.
I believe that's how Curious George found his way to the United States, on a banana boat, right?
Exactly.
You have an international organization at Futera. How much are you able to work remotely, and then how much do you need to just have your clients and your colleagues getting on airplanes? It's a difficult calculus sometimes.
Tell me about it. So we have offices in London, New York, and Stockholm. About 50% of our business is international. It's a bigger issue actually for a small agency like us. You know, we're less than 50 people globally, with most of us, 30 of us in London. And it puts a huge strain. You know, business travel used to be seen as a kind of aspirational bonus. You know, hey, I'm going to Brazil. And then it just becomes a drudge. You know, it becomes something which exhausts people, it tires them out, it burns them out. And so, yeah, we're acutely aware that the more we can reduce it, is better for our team as well.
So the junior associates don't have to travel on cargo ship.
No, we haven't made them sail yet. We do have a travel policy within Europe, which says that if any of our team decide to travel by train instead of by plane on the continent, we actually give them an extra day's leave to compensate for the additional travel time. So they don't lose holiday time by going by train.
That's a really cool idea. The founder of Futera, Ed Gillespie, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by the Budos Band, T-Bone Walker, and Willie Nelson. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week
as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.